air and artillery strikes killed more than 70 in central Gaza as the regime's onslaught on the besieged territory continues unabated. The senior Hamas official says that Israelis have a bad reputation for fulfilling their promises, calling on Palestinians to keep resisting against the occupying regime. Brazil's president has slammed the Israeli onslaught on the Gaza Strip as genocide and a war on women and children.
Well, welcome to the studios here in the capital, Tehran. This is News. Thanks for joining us.
Israel keeps pounding the Gaza Strip, killing more than 70 civilians in fresh air and artillery strikes on and around the central city of Deir al-Balah. A number of people have also been injured there. To the south, 16 people lost their lives following an attack on Khan Yunis. That's the city where Nasser Hospital is located. The medical complex became out of service after repeated Israeli raids and the detention of a large number of staff. Israeli forces do not allow the evacuation of patients to receive treatment at other hospitals. According to the Gaza Health Ministry, around 150 patients are also trapped inside of an old building at the facility without medical care. Israel's genocidal war on Gaza is now in its 136th day. Nearly 29,000 have been killed so far. The majority of them are women and children. While Palestinians displaced in Rafah are struggling with shortages of food, water, and shelter, and now they are increasingly concerned about the possible Israeli ground offensive in the southern Gazan city.
We and the house owner were sitting inside the house, and I stood up to leave. And I asked him if he needed anything. He said, no, I will see you in the morning. I walked away around 700 meters and the airstrike hit the building. And the whole family was martyred. They were wiped out of civil registry, all but two sons, Suleiman and Khalil. Look at the situation we are in and our conditions. They told us Rafah was safe. God is the protector everywhere.
We hope that the international community pressures Israel not to enter Rafah, because the number of people that are in Rafah is big. Even if you want to displace them, how will you do it for such a number? 1.3 million or 1.4 million people need to be displaced. Where will they go?
The ground invasion will exacerbate the problem and add pressure on all the displaced people in the Gaza Strip. Rafah isn't fit for 250,000 people. Today, it hosts more than a million people in a small area, crowded with people. There are no appropriate living conditions, no food, drinks, or housing in this extreme cold. People are suffering from the cold inside the tents that are housing people. Where will they go after this? There is no safe place in the Gaza Strip.
We are fleeing to safety, the safety of our children, our women, and ourselves. And today we have reached the Egyptian border. After here, where can I go? I am 50 meters away from Egypt's border, and they said that Rafah was the safest place. We came to Rafah, and now they want to attack Rafah. Where should they go?
The senior Hamas official says that Israelis have a bad reputation for fulfilling their promises, calling on Palestinians to keep resisting against the occupying regime.
Israelis are not committed to their agreements and promises. They have a long history of not complying with what they agree upon. Palestinians' resistance against the Israeli occupation is the real guarantee for a potential deal, the one that was achieved during the Operation Al-Aqsa Flood. The operation made Israel and the U.S. realize that the axis of resistance is able to exert pressure with the aim of supporting movements in Gaza and change the political equation in favor of the resistance front.
Hamdan said Palestinian resistance fighters have been inflicting losses on Israeli forces in Gaza every day. Hamdan added that the regime has failed to take back by force even a single Israeli captive held in Gaza. He noted that the U.S. is complicit in Israel's massacre of Palestinians. The Hamas representative in Beirut also underlined that the resistance movements in Lebanon, Yemen, and Iraq have exerted additional pressure on the Israeli regime and the U.S. The top UN court held public hearings on the legal consequences of Israeli crimes in the occupied Palestinian territories. Over 50 states, including Iran, will participate in the oral proceedings before the International Court of Justice. The Arab League, the Organization of Islamic Cooperation, and the African Union will also deliver statements. At the request of the UN General Assembly, the ICJ will then issue a non-binding advisory opinion on the legal liability of Israel's occupation of Palestine. Last month, ICJ announced its provisional ruling in a case brought by South Africa against Israel. It called on Israel to cease all activities that could constitute genocide in Gaza. However, the UN Special Rapporteur says that Israel appears to be in breach of that order. Brazil's president has slammed the Israeli onslaught on the Gaza Strip as genocide and a war on women and children.
In the Gaza Strip, there is no war going on. It's a genocide. It's not a war between soldiers and soldiers. It's a war between a highly trained army and women and children.
Lula likened Israeli killings of the Nazi massacres during the Second World War. He also criticized the move by a number of rich countries to cut funding to the Gaza branch of the UN Relief Agency for Palestine. Lula questioned the political conscience of blocking UNRWA's funds. His comments increased pressure on Israel amid international backlash over its planned ground assault in Rafah in the southern Gaza Strip. The city is hosting over 1 million displaced Palestinians who have fled there in a desperate search for safety. But Israel has intensified its airstrikes there in anticipation of a ground incursion. The Yemeni army says it has carried out yet another operation against a British vessel in the Gulf of Aden. The army spokesman says the ship was seriously damaged after being hit with missiles in the Gulf of Aden. Yahya Sari says the freighter, identified as Ruby Mar, has come to a complete halt and is on the verge of sinking. According to the spokesman, the safety of the vessel's crew is secured. The spokesman also said the army has shot down a hostile American MQ-9 drone in Hodeidah. Sari said the army will continue operations against British and American vessels in response to attacks by the U.S. and the U.K. on Yemen and in solidarity with Palestinians. He said such operations will continue until Israel stops its onslaught on Gaza and ends the siege on the Palestinian territory. Abdul Latif al-Washali is a correspondent joining us from Yemen's capital, Sana'a, to tell us more. Well, tell us about what the Yemeni spokesperson, army spokesperson, said, and in terms of that vessel that I guess was targeted. And if I'm not mistaken, he also mentioned something about a plane or a drone, maybe, if that was mentioned. If I heard him correctly, you can elaborate on that for us also.
Thank you so much. Yes, it was a drone. It's an MQ-9 drone, which is an American drone, was carrying out hostile actions against the Yemeni territories. And for the Hodeidah city, the Yemeni army shot down this MQ-9 drone. The Yemeni army has enough experience in dealing with such drones. For 9 years, the Yemeni army has managed to shut down a big number of these drones, MQ-9, which is a very sophisticated drone, and it carries out hostile actions against the Yemeni people and the Yemeni army. The Yemeni army has made it clear since day one that they will never stop attacking the ships in the Red Sea and Gulf of Aden until the siege and the war are stopped against the people in Gaza. You know, the Yemeni army believes that the international community recognizes only the powerful one. They will not do anything for you unless you are powerful, you have force, you have an army, you can do something to harm the countries that are now just backing the Israelis, and they're killing for the Palestinian people. The Yemeni army, I believe, will continue these operations. And today, I believe that this operation comes in response to the U.S. designation that is now has gone in effect, I believe, 2 days ago. So the Yemeni army is telling or sending a message to the U.K. and the U.S. that nothing will stop the Yemeni operations. They are linked to what is happening to the people in Gaza. If the massacre in Gaza stops, the operations will stop.
Thank you very much for that, Abdul Latif al-Bashali from Yemen's capital, Sana'a. Thank you. Moving on, thousands of people have hit the streets of the Canadian city of Calgary to condemn Israel's genocide in Gaza. They also call for sanctions and an arms embargo against the regime. Our correspondent Robert Inlakash has a report from Calgary.
As the assault on Gaza escalates again with the death toll since October 7 nearing 30,000, pro-Palestinian protests are gaining momentum in Canada. During nationwide rallies, protesters criticized Prime Minister Justin Trudeau for his inaction.
Palestinians deserve to remain on their land, to live on their land. We are not looking for an evacuation of Palestinians into the Sinai Desert, which is what the Zionist entity is trying to do right now with Rafah, specifically to push them out. So the urgency of the situation is you know, to ensure that Palestinians can live and live freely on their own land without the bombardment of settler colonization and genocide.
On the cusp of the Israeli invasion of the southernmost city of Gaza, Rafah, the people of Calgary take to the streets, joining cities across Canada, calling on their government to take measures to stop Israel's genocide of the Palestinian people.
I'm here to ask for ceasefire right now. Enough is enough. It has been taking a long time for our government to stand up and call for ceasefire. This is not the right way to do it. We have to get arms embargo.
I'm at a loss for words, to be honest, but what's going on, it's the end of the line. It's a death camp, and we want to, again, pressure our politicians, pressure our communities, hands off Rafah.
Although the government of Canada has called for a ceasefire, demonstrators noted that since October, Ottawa has approved $28.5 million of military exports to Israel. They see this, along with the refusal of the Canadian government to call the assault on Gaza genocide, tantamount to a stab in the back of the public's demands. Robert and Lakesh, Calgary.
Iran has lashed out at the U.S. Senate for approving yet another aid package to Israel amid the regime's genocidal campaign in the besieged Gaza Strip. Foreign Ministry spokesman Nasser Kanani said the funding signifies that the Israeli Prime Minister, alongside other executioners in the Gaza conflict, will be rewarded with a daily sum of $100 million for massacring Palestinians. Kanani added that only corrupt systems like the American government can squander money for the merciless killing of innocents. On Thursday, the U.S. Senate approved the motion, which included more than $14 billion aid package to Israel in what are called security assistance for Tel Aviv. That move has sparked widespread criticism both at home and abroad. The U.S. has provided Israel with the highest amount of military assistance since its creation in occupied Palestine. Iran is preparing for parliament and the Assembly of Experts elections on March the 1st. Leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, says that election is the main pillar of the Islamic Republic. Earlier in our news review program, we discussed the issue with our guests.
Time now for the news review. Stay tuned. The leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution has described the elections as the main pillar of the Islamic establishment. Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei says in a meeting with the people from East Azerbaijan province that everyone should participate in the elections. The leader said that that's the way forward to reform the country and to address the existing problems. The leader called on voters to choose the most competent candidates. He added that elections have always been clean in Iran, stressing that political differences should not negatively impact national unity against enemies. Elections for Iran's parliament and the Assembly of Experts are scheduled for March the 1st. All right, now allow me to invite a couple of guests to discuss this and shed some more light on this. So Hakima Saghai Birri, academic and political analyst, joining me from Tehran. Also with me is Sayyid Mohammad Marandi, university lecturer and political analyst in Tehran. Well, Mr. Marandi will probably join us later. Let's begin with Hakima. To start with, let's talk about the significance of elections in Iran. We have had many elections held so far, and the establishment attaches much importance to this. And as the leader of the Islamic Revolution called it, this is considered as a pillar of the Islamic establishment. Let us and the viewers know why this is so important.
Yes, thank you for having me, and let me say my greetings to you and to the viewers. We have to remember that the Islamic Revolution, basically the Islamic Republic, was born to a world where two basic political systems were operating and basically dominated the world. On the one hand, we had communism, and on the other, we had liberal democracy, in which, in this world, we had the Islamic Revolution and then the Islamic Republic, which gave a third option to the people of the world, which was an Islamic Republic, in which we have the Islamic nature of the system, but at the same time, it is a people-centered political system in which we have elections. We have had more than 40 elections since the beginning of the revolution, and of course, this year we are having this in just less than 2 weeks. We are having two important elections. One is the parliamentary, and the other one is the Assembly of Experts, which is responsible for electing the leader.
Let me ask Professor Merendi about the Western media. You know, they have launched so much ballyhoo, and they are spreading adverse propaganda against the upcoming elections in Iran. Tell us why they don't want the Iranian people to go to the ballot boxes and to the polls.
We are at a turning point in history. The United States and Israel and Europe are on the decline, and this is a historic opportunity for the region to find its feet for the first time since literally centuries. And therefore, the West and the United States in particular will do anything to weaken Iran or the resistance or the axis of resistance at this moment in time. They are in a very bad state. And they have their internal problems, as we all know, with the U.S. elections coming up and the tensions that exist in the country. They have political problems that are very serious with China, and Latin America is no longer obeying as they did before. Africa is shifting. Asia has changed. And they have a war. They have a major war going on in Ukraine, and that war is causing deep divisions in the United States, and they're losing the war, we've seen over the last few days.
Akim Esaghaibiri, academic and political analyst, said Mohammad Merendi, university lecturer and political analyst, both in Tehran.
And that does it for this edition of World News. Bye-bye for now.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. This is the Heart of Life Pounding. IRIB English Radio.
Economic divide.
When the U.S.-Israeli genocidal war against the Gaza Strip began, Israel thought it could wrap up this aggression within a short period of time. Over 4 months now, going into the fifth month, Israel has realized that was just a pipe dream, and it didn't anticipate the costs involved and how it's draining its purse. Just a couple of angles we'll be looking at in this edition of Economic Divide. Taking a look at some of the highlights of this program, Israel's economic crisis. We'll break it down. There's been a credit downgrade by Moody's, also the budget deficit, and the GDP decrease, obviously all negative economic indicators for Israel. Then we will take a look at a huge concern, and these are the mounting costs that are occurring for Israel. It has to subsidize salaries of 360,000 reservists who are also workers that contribute to the society. At this point, they're not because they're fighting an illegal genocide. Then you have the cost of the aggression itself, $59.3 billion for the year, with the daily cost to be between either $246 million or $272 million. Then the illegal settlement economy, confrontation with Hezbollah, a mistake, thousands of businesses closed in the north, and also $131 million agricultural loss. Just some of the angles we'll be looking at in terms of the losses from the settlements and the products there. More than 4 months have passed since Israel started its brutal genocide on the Gaza Strip. The onslaught has killed thousands of Palestinian people. The Israeli military has also suffered significant losses, but the economy of the regime has also been negatively impacted by the onslaught. It has rendered Israel's crisis city economy even more fragile. From a complete halt in tourism to global shipping challenges, there's not a single sector in the economy that has been sheltered from the shockwaves of the genocide. Since October, Israel has subsidized the salaries of reportedly 360,000 mobilized reservists who have been deployed to Gaza, many of whom are high-tech industry workers in finance, artificial intelligence, pharmaceuticals, and agriculture. In November, the Bank of Israel put the onslaught's gross effects on Israel at $53 billion and pared back its estimates for economic growth to 2% per year from 2023 and 2024, down from 2.3% and 2.8%. In December, Israel's finance ministry said that the onslaught will likely cost Israel approximately $13.8 billion this year if its high-intensity phase concludes during the first quarter of 2024. These staggering costs, which could very easily rise, especially if another front develops with Hezbollah, leads to the question of how the regime will fund the onslaught's effort. The impact on Israel's high-tech sector, which is considered the engine of the regime's economy, is significant. According to economists, 10% of Israeli employees work in the high-tech sector, but they are responsible for 50% of the regime's exports. Time now to take a look at what's posted online. We begin with a website which has stated that Moody's has lowered Israeli credit rating, downgrading its outlook from stable to negative. At the same time, the agency has warned public finances are deteriorating, and it has predicted materially higher debt burden amid the, well, they call it war, we call it an onslaught in Gaza, and it says to have lowered the outlook due to the risk of escalation with Hezbollah. Now, the Israeli Prime Minister has said the rating will go back up the moment we win this war. Next up, taking a look at this post, the Gaza war has cost Israel more than $60 billion so far. Is anyone tallying the cost to American taxpayers of the U.S. armed forces coming to Israel's rescue and fighting on its behalf throughout the region? It poses that as a question. Next, Palestinians fear Israel's economic chokehold will not end with or without a ceasefire. This post went on to say Israel is canceling work permits, restricting travel, withholding tax revenues, and West Bank Palestinians are saying that these are the types of problems that they're facing. And finally, Israel promising some relief to hemorrhaging West Bank economy in a covert meet with the PA officials. All right, those were some of the posts. I have to wait and see how the economy of the West Bank as a whole can recover from this based on the restrictions by Israel. Anyways, let me bring in our guest for our first Q&A. Arturo Hartman Pacheco joins us. He is a researcher in international relations with a focus on Palestine and Israel. He's also a member of the International Center for Arab and Islamic Studies at the Federal University of Sirgip. Welcome to the program, Arturo Hartman Pacheco. Let's start out with what has occurred over here when it comes to the economic crisis that Israel is facing. I mean, we're looking at so many different negative economic indicators. You have a decreasing GDP. You have costs that are accruing mainly because of this illegal U.S.-Israel genocidal war. The crisis also involves so many facets of the economy that's hemorrhaging basically money. And the question that comes about is, how long can Israel sustain this? And actually, how bad is this economic crisis that Israel is facing?
Well, when we talk about the question of the economy in Israel, so the point, I think, the first thing we got to say is how it's affecting some economic sectors, right? So what we heard and what we can see by the news that are coming and the reports that are being made is that is affecting a lot in the, so two sectors that we can take as examples, right? The technology sector and the agricultural sector. In the case of the technology sector, there's a huge workforce that, because the workers in the technology sector mainly are reservists in the Israeli army. So a lot of them are actually in Gaza, in the operations and Israeli attacks over Gaza. So we have a shortage of workforce in the sector, which is that compose around 18% of the Israeli economy. And the agricultural sector serves another problem, which is the lack of workforce. So mainly the agricultural sector is composed, the workforce is composed of Palestinians, especially from the West Bank. But because of restrictions that Israel is imposing on Palestinians, you have a lack of workforce, so it's impacting the agricultural force. It's still early to actually realize what kind of impact in GDP you're going to have in Israel. But people are already talking about 2-3%, which is huge.
All right, thank you for that. Let me bring in our next guest, Mark Sloboda, joins us. Mark Sloboda is a former senior lecturer and researcher at the Faculty of Sociology of Moscow State University. Mark Sloboda, welcome to the program. The economic crisis that Israel is facing is pretty severe when you take a look at it. But the one sector that has been affected probably the most is the technology sector. They've been emptied out of the workers there. You're looking at also another facet of the technology sector, maybe as a whole, where there's a huge decrease in investments, particularly this sector, to have experienced 50% decrease. What do you think? Any hopes of a recovery there?
Yeah, these are the two big costs. The technology sector has been the biggest sector of the Israeli economy, amounting for some 18% of the economy total. And if it a foreign investment is down 50%, and then you compound that with the loss of the huge portion of the labor force, large numbers of these ex-military people, these working in the tech sector, it is a fairly substantial amount of damage. As long as this conflict continues, and it shows no sign of abating anytime soon, it actually shows sign of expanding. Netanyahu has been making increasingly belligerent remarks about expanding the war himself in Israel, moving its forces north into Lebanon to go after Hezbollah, the U.S. Expanding the conflict to include the Ar Ansalah movement, the Houthis in Yemen as well. They're now talking about a protracted campaign there. There's no chance of a recovery of the technology sector while the conflict continues, and the costs to it will continue to exponentially accrue over time. Even after the conflict ends, it may take years for the Israeli technology sector to recover from this.
Time now for the InfoNews section of the program. Let's start out with something that's really huge that's happening in the EU, and that is the EU farmers' protest. Yes, EU has announced compensation to farmers. That's the good news. As protests, however, are flaring up. A block-wide wave of discontent is happening over high cost, external competition, and also red tape. And that's just some of them, which is happening in the agricultural sector. At this point, Spain has joined in, but there's so many other EU countries that have cumulatively now voicing their opposition to so many things. It's even hard to talk about it because it's hard to know which part to start from. Anyways, another piece of news related to EU, and it's the oil sales that concerns Russia. EU states are actually buying Russian energy, but on the sly. Oil and gas are still reaching the block by a third countries. These include the Asia-Pacific region, countries of the Global South, and others. Next up, a tax hike that has occurred in Indonesia and is rather alarming. Basically, it has brought people out saying there's nothing left. where Indonesia's tourism industry is fearing a wipeout under this proposed tax hike. There are plans to introduce between 40 to 75% tax rate for entertainment services, and that has prompted fierce backlash from businesses. Now, amid this blowback, the government has announced that it would delay the hike pending an evaluation. And then finally, we'll take a look at Argentina and its economy. Well, the Argentina police are actually out on the streets. They have battled protesters due to the fact that protesters are opposing this so-called omnibus reform bill. This bill touches on all areas of public and private life, from privatizations to cultural issues, the penal code even, and even divorce and the status of football clubs. So the Argentinian president obviously has a lot on his hands when it comes to this bill. Those were the items we picked for the InfoNews section.
You're listening to Economic Divide. This series looks at the financial health of the economies around the world and its impact on countries. You can listen to Economic Divide on Mondays and Tuesdays on IRIB English Radio.
It's time now for the in-depth section of the program. Is Israel suffering from an economic crisis? You bet it is. How much of a crisis, though, is it suffering from? Well, it was enough for Moody's to actually downgrade its credit rating. That much we know. In this in-depth section, we're going to take a look at other aspects of Israel's economy which point to this crisis. Our first look is a comparison of Israel's gross domestic budget deficit between the years 2023 and 2022. Now, when you take a look at this budget deficit for 2023, it has come in at 4.2%. That equals $20.7 billion. Now, that is while in the year 2022, it saw a surplus of 0.6%. So it's no surprise that the deficit jumped by 0.8% in December to the figure 4.2% at the height of the Israeli aggression against the Gaza Strip. Now, as we have done in previous programs, Israel's aggression spending has been spiraling out of control, but we need to take a look at it. One figure has put that aggression cost, with the figure being at $59.3 billion, as you see there. It put the daily cost at around $269 million daily. Some figures actually have put that figure at a lot higher. We took this from the Times of Israel, where Israel has cited that. Next, this is where Israel is getting into trouble, since it is having a hard time keeping up with the costs, especially military ones. Now, to pay for the military spending, one of the things it had to do was it had to increase it by $18.6 billion. When that is compared to Israel's revenues, like, let's say, from taxes, well, it's easy to see why Israel is falling short. Israeli tax revenues for the year 2023 was $30 billion lower than projected. And finally, consumer confidence is really important. At this point, Israel is suffering from that. And it has fallen quite a bit due to the aggression. And now that the aggression keeps dragging on, it keeps decreasing the consumer confidence. Inflation, as a result, is now a very major concern. Israel has put the inflation percentage somewhere in the vicinity of, to have risen to 5.3%. There's some of the other areas where the Bank of Israel has come into play. Fiscal discipline is recommending, reduction in spending, and, of course, taxes to be raised. And finally, in terms of the concerns that Israel has, well, the aggression is going to continue from what we're seeing right now, especially rhetoric coming out of the defiant Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. And then we have the Red Sea shipping crisis, which adds to the economic worries for Israel. All right, let's bring back our guests and find out what they think and what direction Israel's economy is going to be going. Arturo Hartman Pacheco rejoins us, researcher in international relations with a focus on Palestine and Israel. Welcome back to the program. I'd like to get an idea from you when it comes to the illegal settlements, but these are areas in Israel, especially in the northern part, where there is an agricultural concentration. in terms of what happens there, obviously, you have a production that takes place there. The food basket production, obviously, is a big worry now for Israel because it's been impacted so hard based on the genocidal war. Extensive damage to this sector, which has prevented, ultimately, food production. What is your outlook on this sector? Where is it heading to?
Well, there's a lot of things that we can unpack here. The main workforce laboring in the agricultural sector and harvesting and cultivating are Palestinians. Palestinians from the West Bank, legally, between commas here, between quotes here, and illegally. So you already have a big impact on the agricultural sector. And the problem with agriculture is that you can lose harvests if you don't work on that. So this is the first thing. But also we have to look the impact over to the Palestinians, right? So Palestine, and I'm not talking about Gaza, okay? I'm talking about the West Bank. You're going to have a dilemma because of the occupation, the illegal occupation over the West Bank. One of the tactics, one of the methods is that you link the Israeli economy to the Palestinian economy, which is illegal under international humanitarian law and the occupation law. You're going to have a problem of supply to the Palestinians through the Israeli product that even if they try to boycott, they are cheaper and they offer more supply. But also for the salaries, they're not being paid to the Palestinians because they are not working in Israel or either because Israel is holding the revenues of the Palestinian Authority. So the Palestinian Authority is not paying salaries.
All right, very well. Let's bring Mark Sloboda back. Mark Sloboda is a former senior lecturer and researcher at the Faculty of Sociology of Moscow State University. Mark Sloboda, welcome back. You know, I want to get an idea from you about Israel's economy as a whole. And really, what are we looking at over here? I mean, in terms of the aggression itself, it's lasted more than 4 months now. Obviously, there's costs that are involved there, quite high. Some estimates putting it at around $269 million daily. We're looking at falling GDP. We're looking at inflation that has crept up. And all sorts of negative economic indicators, including the Moody's downgrade, and even areas in Israel that are just empty, and businesses either are halfway closed or shut down. How bad an economic crisis is Israel facing?
I think that the drop in economic activity, the costs of the conflict, both military and economic, on the Israeli regime are fairly severe and will have to be factored into Israeli decision making about the future of the conflict going forward. The Washington Post has estimated that the war is costing the Israeli government about $250 million a day. That may very well be a severe underestimate. They also project that if the war would carry on for another few months through 2024, that the grand total cost of the conflict to the Israeli economy could be $50 billion or more. The Israeli finance ministry has been making increasingly pleading and desperate messages to Netanyahu that taxes need to be hiked. And the damage to the Israeli economy is across the board, across all sectors. Those have to do with, one, the large number of the Israeli high-tech workers, in particular, who have been called up for reservist duty. So the government not only has to pay salaries to all of the hundreds of thousands of reservists it's called up, but their services are being lost. Their labor is being lost to the economy.
One of the sectors of the Israeli economy that has suffered the most amid the onslaught is tourism, which accounted for 2.6% of the GDP before the pandemic in 2019. Prior to Operation Al-Aqsa Flood, visitors to Israel numbered above 300,000 each month. In November, that figure reportedly sank to 39,000. Construction, which ordinarily relies on Palestinian labor from the West Bank, has ground to a near halt. Israel has suspended the work permits of more than 100,000 Palestinians. A war that lasts 5 to 10 more months could cost Israel as much as $50 billion or even more. The onslaught has already taken an economic toll in these northern and southern regions of the occupied territories. Towns are emptied of people. Businesses are shuttered. Farm fields lay untended, putting production timelines in jeopardy. In short, the double economic shock on supply and demand could become an unprecedented macroeconomic crisis for Israel, with some Israeli economists estimating the accumulated cost to be 10% of the GDP if the aggression lasts for a year. The economic toll of this violence may cost Israel an estimated $400 billion in lost economic activity over the next decade. For Israel, 90% of the economic shock will come from indirect effects: reduced investment, slowing productivity growth, and labor market disruption.
Hello and welcome to the Quick Take section. I'm Matt Yaposyan. Israel's economic troubles just got worse with the downgrading of its credit rating by Moody's Investor Service. The credit rating, given by several rating firms throughout the year, is an assessment of Israel's credibility regarding its financial obligations and debt. This is the first time Moody's has lowered Israel's credit rating. Moody's downgraded Israel from A1 to A2 and said the outlook for the regime's economy was negative. Moody's concluded that the war and its aftermath will materially raise political risks for Israel for the foreseeable future. Moody's expects that Israel's debt burden will be materially higher than projected before the conflict. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has remained defiant in his response to the rating by the Moody's. This type of reaction, playing down Moody's decision, is another sign of instability within Israel. The Israeli Prime Minister said in reaction, "The Israeli economy is strong," adding that the rating downgrade is not connected to the economy. It is entirely due to the fact that we are in a war. Israel's finance minister had the same type of reaction, more or less, dismissing the decision. He said the announcement reflects a lack of confidence in Israel's security and national strength, and also a lack of confidence in the righteousness of Israel's path against the enemies. But Israel's PM Netanyahu and finance minister Smotrich should be worried. Moody's downgrade could lead other major agencies also to downgrade Israel's outlook. If other agencies travel down the path, that could impact Israel's economy because it will make it harder for Israel to raise money by selling bonds. So far, Israel has amended its annual budget. It exercised a 3% budget cut across the board to try to compensate for the spike in its military operation costs. Israel is also mulling over whether it will increase value-added tax by 1% in 2025 or not. And that does it for this Quick Take section.
The Israeli Prime Minister Netanyahu is being defiant, and he's also reckless at the same time for pushing ahead with this genocidal war. It's risking not only himself and Israel at the same time, but the entire West Asia region, banking on winning a genocidal war that he knows he can't win. After all, he has not achieved any of his stated goals, from releasing the captives or to eliminating Hamas. At the same time, Israel is bleeding money. That does it for this edition of Economic Divide. Thank you so much for being with us. Hope you enjoyed it. From Mikhail Vitali and the entire team here at Economic Divide, it's goodbye until the next program.
وقضى ربك ألا تعبدوا إلا إياه وبالوالدين إحسانا.
Your Lord has decreed that you shall not worship anyone except Him, and He has enjoined kindness to parents. For humanity.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Salaam alaikum wa rahmatullah. This is Hussein Latifi, and you're listening to your program For Humanity from IRIB English Radio. In this program, we talk about different dimensions of the human soul. We talk about humanity in the Holy Quran, and we talk about different dimensions, different verses of the Holy Quran talking about the human being. And in the previous episodes, we talked about different faculties of the soul, the heart, and we ended the discussion there, and we started the discussion about human intellect. Talking about human intellect and aql, the concept of reason and intellect in the Holy Quran, we said that in order to understand the position of intellect, definition of intellect, we should also know the opposite notions, so that we have a clearer understanding of what Quran means by intellect and reason. And we ended up talking about an old historical debate between atheists and theists, believers and disbelievers. And mainly disbelievers believe that they are the smart ones. They reject faith and they reject any notion about God, and this is because they're very clever. And Quran says no, exactly the opposite. This is foolish to reject religion. And in this episode, we want to talk about why is it foolish. One reason for that, according to the ahadith that we have. Now, in the Western philosophy, this is attributed to Pascal. They call it wager, Pascal wager. But centuries before Pascal, we had that in the Islamic literature, Islamic heritage, at least in the Shia heritage. Imam Sadiq alayhi salam made that equation, that a person went to the Imam and said, okay, they were sitting in Masjid al-Haram, people were turning around Kaaba and doing tawaf. And the person said, this is a useless act they're doing. What's the benefit of that? Nobody has ever seen the hereafter. Nobody has come from the after death to say if there's any reality or truth in the claims of the prophets. And so they're just wasting their time. And he thought very smart of himself. And everybody present there, they were waiting for the response of the Imam, Imam Sadiq alayhi salam. So the Imam said, okay, let's make it a practical decision. Okay? If these people are wrong, then what they have lost is a very small thing. Because the time that people spend for religion is not that much. Like 10 minutes prayer here, like a journey of 10 days to Mecca. How much of your life is that? It's like not even 100th of your life. So they have lost only this. And anyways, if you were not following a religion, it wasn't like you were going to kill this and do that because you claim you are living a moral life and you actually adhere to the moral lives and all the principles that are there. So it's not like you having great pleasures out of religion. No, we actually share the same thing based on your claim. So that is one possibility. But there is another probability. The claim is true because you're not sure that there is no day of judgment, there is nothing after death, you go to nothingness. No, you're not sure because you said it and nobody is sure about that. So if that takes place, who is going to lose what? Now this is a very big and important question. We will have a break and we continue this interesting story in the next segment.
Dear listeners, you are listening to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. You can send us your emails, comments, and questions at englishradio@irib.ir.
Welcome back. This is Hussein Latifi, and you're listening to a program for humanity from IRIB English Radio. We were talking about the Paschal wager, but the version, the Islamic version of it, which came centuries before Paschal in the heritage of Islam. So we were saying that a person went to the Imam Sadiq alayhi salam, and he said that the people who are doing tawaf, they are just wasting their time. And the Imam said there are two possibilities. Either what we say about the hereafter is not correct, or it is correct. So if it is not correct, then we have not lost anything special. Just some days of our life, okay, we have wasted. But let's see what happens if what we say is correct and what you're claiming is not correct. That is, what happens if there is a day of judgment, and on the day of judgment, these people are going to have eternal bliss, eternal life, and you're going to lose eternity. How can you put the odds together? How much is important? Eternity, you're talking about losing eternity. That's why Quran says, "Ala innahum humus sufa." Even with the calculative mind of a person who goes to business, okay, he says, okay, it doesn't harm to believe. Because, as I said, at the end of the day, you have to live morally. A lot of laws are common among believers and non-believers. And just to hold the belief in your heart about the day of judgment and do a little bit of prayer here and there doesn't take much out of a person in comparison to the great reward that it has. Why? Because this is, at the end of the day, limited life. 10 years, 7 years, 100 years, it finishes. But what about eternity? If you destroy a deal that has eternity on its end because of some limited thing, then you're foolish. This is a foolish deal, according to the definition. Remember we said foolishness, technical definition, is a person who does not know the value of things. And Quran says, فَمَا رَبِحَتْ تِجَارَتُهُمْ. Those who sell their soul, sell the eternity in return for dunya. Yes, they get something in return, which is dunya. It's like that kid who goes and gives $1,000 in return of a snack. And a snack is delicious. Nobody says a snack is bad. Nobody says it's nothing that he receives. But when you look at the equation, it doesn't make sense at all. So, Allah innahum humus sufaha. Quran says, actually, they're the stupid and foolish ones. Those who reject this possibility, this deal, which doesn't take much out of them. How much does it take for you to believe? Quran says, this is as old as history. قَالَ الْمَلَأُ الَّذِينَ كَفَرُوا مِنْ قَوْمِهِ إِنَّا لَنَرَاكَ فِي سَفَاهَةٍ. The first label that they could come up with against Anbiya, against the prophets and the followers of the prophets, was that stupidity. We see foolishness in your claim. Those people in the pagan societies, مِنْ قَوْمِهِ, from the tribe of a prophet, إِنَّا لَنَرَاكَ فِي سَفَاهَةٍ. We see you in a kind of stupid, you're foolish. And then he says, قَالَ يَا قَوْمِ لَيْسَ بِي سَفَاهَةٍ. This is not stupidity. This is not foolishness. This is actually something about the eternal life that I'm talking to. So this is very important. Inshallah, in the following episode, we talk about other verses about Safaha and about intellect and other words talking about intellect in the Holy Quran. Thank you very much for listening. Until next episode, Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Sallallahu ala Muhammad, sallallahu ala Nabi, sallallahu ala Muhammad, wa ala ali Nabi. Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.